Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, September 10th, 2011. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. And our headline title for this week's show is LaRouche's Real Jobs Program, the North American Water and Power Alliance, and Planetary Reconstruction. Now, to discuss this today, I'm glad we have, begin with here in the studio, live with me, Paul Gallagher. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you. Hi, Marcia.
And Paul is with EIR now and for a long time in the economic section. And I will be referring later, but the week before Labor Day's EIR Online carried Paul's article surveying the world-scale unemployment, literally those out of a job. We'll get to that, namely the inactivity on a world scale. But I want to welcome to the show from LaRouche PAC TV, Dennis Mason. Welcome, Dennis.
Hi, Marcia.
And Dennis has been, he's often on many kinds of teams. I believe, Dennis, we could say you're on the team that's very much involved in putting out the new presidency series or the candidate series. Is that right?
Yeah, the World in Review show.
Yes. So by way of introduction to what you can imagine we're discussing, what I just described, is I want to begin on a happy note. It's qualified, but it's very happy that Lyndon LaRouche celebrated his 89th birthday this week with friends in person and with friends around the world at a distance. And let me just say, true to form of his own unique creative self and also our human species in general, he chose this occasion in the last 48 hours to reiterate certain points in the celebration of the truth that we have to face today, that we're in an epic situation of, as he said, having entered a breakdown phase on the world on the world economy and civilization, but it doesn't have to be the end. But it can be. It doesn't have to mean extinction for our species, but we, as a creative species, we, being mankind, we have to meet the test. Now, I'm not going to say more now. Dennis Mason has been meeting with Mr. LaRouche recently on certain breaking events today. But September 7th, this week, Mr. LaRouche did issue an emergency international address on just what I'm describing, that we... Now is the decision point. It's not that the breakdown is pending. It's underway. The disasters you see in the United States and elsewhere in the world, we're talking about flooding, drought, a new earthquake registering itself just off the British Columbia, Washington State, Vancouver Island coast, this kind of thing. Mr. LaRouche discussed that, and over last Labor Day weekend, I'm pointing this out because of Paul Gallagher being our guest, LaRouche PAC TV posted that weekend, I think on September 4th, the seven necessary steps of what we have to do about this. The latest EIR Online, I think, is featuring step number one. We have to get Obama out of the presidency, step aside, resign him, impeach him, whatever you want to do, and make way for the real work and jobs program for the United States and the world by reinstituting the Glass-Steagall Law we had in 1933. So those seven steps are posted on LaRouche PAC, and they've been the step number one is featured in the latest EIR Online. And we just come around to the picture that right after Labor Day, here's the world in this situation. Mr. LaRouche himself, and I hope all of you listening and everyone working with LaRouche Political Action Committee are working to have a big policy shift fast. But September 8th, Obama, as president, went to Congress and gave his so-called job speech with, let me just put it this way, our guests can speak about it more. He called on its own merits for hideous things, for programs to destroy labor, to reduce Social Security, to cut health, to have more fierce globalization. He said it would create jobs to have free trade agreements with Panama, Colombia, and South Korea. We could go on and on. But one thing outstanding is on Thursday evening, the 8th, is when Tropical Storm Lee was dumping rain all over the Northeast, including in the District of Columbia, where Obama was speaking, and not only himself, but his monitors, that's one and the same, but his controllers in the White House who write his speeches, he didn't even mention any of this, that there were 100,000 people in shelters in the Northeast as of that time, or had to evacuate, I put it that way. Not to mention the fires, the electricity outages in the West, and many other things. So that's the situation we have to discuss today. And I'll leave it with this, that I think Obama said, oh, don't worry, everyone, I'm coming back September 19th on a Monday, and I'm going to issue still more ways in which we're going to kill you in order to balance the budget. He didn't use those words, but that's what it was about. So let's begin there, Paul. Why don't you start with this, with the real meaning of his so-called jobs program?
Well, it's certainly totally opposed to the way that most, you need LPAC TV, because the way this is being covered in general is nonsense. A disgustingly cynical speech. The coverage of it is similar. on the one hand, he used an address to the Congress in order to give a presidential campaign speech on his own behalf and start his presidential campaign and demand that citizens pressure the Congress to support him and so on. But more to the point, the content of it, it was publicized as a job speech, and then he came out and said he wants $4 trillion cut from the spending of the federal government. He won't give that up, even though he was defeated on it repeatedly during this summer. He won't give it up. He comes back to it, and he says now, with the fig leaf of mentioning a few so-called jobs programs, I'm going to again demand that the super committee cut not $1.5 trillion, but $3 trillion, plus the $1 trillion that's already been cut in the debt ceiling agreement, so-called, at least $3 trillion more. And I'm going to tell them how to do it in a week. So what you really had Obama doing in this speech was making clear not only is he the 13th member of the super committee, but he intends to run the super committee in a completely unconstitutional power grab against the Congress as a whole, both in the way the committee is set up and in the fact that he intends to dominate it and now is attempting to give it orders that it has to come up with not even what the legislation said it should come up with, but rather more than twice that in cuts, cutting Social Security benefits, raising the age of retirement still further, cutting health care for seniors. And then you look at this so-called Georgia Works thing that he wants to make a national job proposal. This would make people work off their unemployment benefits. Now, unemployment benefits average a little over $300 a week, maybe $1,500 a month. Think about that for a second. No one contemplates living on that, which is why so many of these people who are on unemployment benefits have moved with their relatives, with their friends, or in the process of becoming homeless. It's why so many of them are also trying to get disability benefits, which is putting a greater burden on the Social Security system, which pays these, because possibly unemployment benefits plus disability benefits, you know, you might be able to survive. And now Obama's proposal is make them work for this, right? So this is instead of employing construction workers like he's talking about, employ unemployed people to work for $350 a week at most. Some states have made it even lower, down to $250 a week. This is slavery in the guise of job creation. This is absolutely unconstitutional. Another executive power grab by Obama, an attempt to take constitutional powers away from the Congress, for which he should be impeached. In terms of the inadequacy of the numbers he's talking about, that's another question, because that assumes that he meant them,
yes.
you know, as anything other than a pretext for cutting Social Security and Medicare and the defense budget and everything else. So I just think that should be clear. We can discuss the scale of the problem as we go along.
Let me just ask one thing, although Dennis can interject at any time. But on this, what you're saying, I mentioned about disasters. If you take what firemen, police, water rescues, EMT, emergency medical techs, and others are trying to cope with, many, they are in such a reduced workforce in the Northeast or in Texas or in the Missouri or Mississippi systems. Paul, you've said recently about 600,000 jobs in the public sector, which includes a lot of these, have been lost just in the last 3 or 4 years?
In the last 4 years, really since the beginning of the serious beginning of this financial breakdown crisis, right in mid-2007 when LaRouche warned it's on, that first year, Bernanke and the others have forgotten about, but that's when LaRouche said it's on, that's when it started, the collapse. Since then, states and cities and the federal government have eliminated 600,000 jobs.
Government, local, state, and county, and federal.
That's right. You know, far more than anybody is talking about re-employing. So the approach is completely wrong. We have to have the approach instead of a really massive national investment in new infrastructure platforms and in emergency relief for the states and the counties, which have lost so many of they're now in a position of having to respond to flooding, fires, power outages, drought, massive river flooding disruptions, and so forth, all with 600,000 fewer people to do the job, police and fire and sanitation and water management and purification workers and so on, and health workers to do the job.
Right. Let me just throw in here one piece of local, not local, we're speaking of the United States and around the world, but in the District of Columbia area, at the time the jobs speech, so-called, by Obama was made, the people who were evacuated, they were under orders in what's called Prince William County, across the river from the District of Columbia. Most of them are from the mobile trailer park. They have nowhere to go back to. So now the county officials are trying to find homeless shelters, which were cut by the Virginia budget for defraying their costs, in which to put people. Now that's maybe 100 people. Multiply that, you have thousands in that situation in this very extensive area of central and eastern Pennsylvania, downstate New York, upstate New York it's called, south central New York, where you have thousands of people. They have nowhere else to go to. So you've upped your homeless population in a matter of 72 hours. In the context of what you're just describing of demobilizing a huge amount of the workforce of the country. So well, let me turn to Dennis. This is the kind of thing you've been addressing in some of the planning for what you can issue forth as ammunition for people to just face this square on. And you've been having these series, the 7 necessary steps of what we ought to do in the country, but also the candidates you've been working with. Would you say something about that?
Yes, sure. I mean, I think that what we've been discussing here so far only goes to show how important that the first step is, which is to get rid of Obama. I mean, look, when you bring up that during his so-called job speech, you have the entire country, which is completely disintegrating. And we actually, on the LaRouche PAC site, we have a news update on this breaking news, floods, fires, and Nero, which was put out right after that. Number one, this guy is not in reality whatsoever. And, you know, I think that a lot of this discussion on, you know, taxing this or financing that, thinking in these sorts of monetary terms, is really an indication of not facing up to the reality that this system in its entirety is dead right now. and there isn't going to be any kind of jimmying around of numbers of funds or whatnot, which is going to deal with it. For example, when you look up and down the East Coast in the wake of these hurricanes, and you know, it really is, I think, important to keep in mind that we're only halfway through the hurricane season. There are three named storms. You know, one has started heading back across the Atlantic, but you know, the fact that we're getting essentially the Haiti treatment from this president, you know, it really serves to, number one, people, I think, have more of a sense of what it means to be headed into an economic collapse. Because if you drive this on further, right, this is just a few things that have happened during this presidency. Now, imagine what would occur if we don't take steps to deal with this crisis further on. And you can really get a sense of what it means when, you know, people like the World Wildlife Foundation, Prince Philip, Schellenhuber, and the whole WGBU crowd in Europe, when they're talking about reducing the population down to 1 billion in the short term, what that actually looks like. It's not through, you know, going out and killing people with wars per se, but when you look at the capacity to spread waterborne diseases, which we saw happen in Haiti, we knew it was going to happen. We didn't take any steps to deal with it, and now you have all the cholera there. And now if you look up and down the East Coast of the United States of America, you're seeing the same thing happen. Now, you're not going to approach this, I don't think, from a local kind of standpoint. I think that the real way, because, you know, there's, I don't know if you can call it an irony per se, but when you look at what Obama was trying to put forward as saying we're going to make jobs, okay, that's neat. But when you look at all the work that is ahead of us in this nation, even in terms of dealing with the extreme weather events that we've seen throughout the year, the flooding that's most recent, there's nothing but that's been done about Joplin, Missouri. We still have flooding in the north and northwestern part of the United States. When you go down to the southwestern part of the United States, you have severe drought. There's no lack of work. There's nothing. The only thing which prevents us from putting a real work program into place is purely the guts to make the political decision to do so. And so, you know, even in terms of the short term dealing with the consequences of these disasters, you have that on the one hand. But then when you take a look into the future of what our nation needs, and you look at a project on the scale of NWAPA, right, where you're managing the biosphere, you're managing the available water resources, and bringing that down into the main part of the continent, replenishing our aquifers, replenishing the Great Lakes, basically attacking the great North American desert, attacking that with mankind's capability. Now, if there's a couple things that does. One is that provides the United States with a national mission objective, and you're not going to be able to deal even with these things that we've been discussing in terms of the cuts in first responders to be able to deal with the emergencies that have been coming up, or dealing with these, you know, there's a lot of bridges that have been washed out where townships, entire communities are cut off from the rest of civilization because we don't have the capacity to rebuild the bridges. Now, if you subsume this with a national project, that's how you're going to get it done. There's no reallocation of some imagined fixed set of finances on the state level or even at the federal level that, you know, as many people have been saying, had already said during the floods in relation to when the farm bureaus were going to FEMA asking for funds to deal with the floods, and FEMA was already then in the middle of the summer saying we don't have any money to deal with this. So if we recognize that the system itself is dead, Once we have that recognition and then act from that standpoint, getting Obama out of any position to make the decisions of the United States government, then when we do that, and this is the first step of the seven necessary steps, the series that you would reference, then when we do that and we can implement Glass-Steagall, that then is where you can generate the credit to be able to deal with these things in a very real way.
Right. Well, let me throw something in here. Because you're talking about under Glass-Steagall in 1933, and then there were great projects. The Four Corners were worked on in the sense of the Columbia River Basin regulation, the Colorado River Basin regulation, and so forth, without going through that. And then you got toward the end of the 30s for certain reasons of the larger solar environment. I'm sure the galaxy figures in, I can't say what. At the end of the 30s, there were big storms in the Ohio Valley in New England. And Paul, Dennis was just talking about the scale of what you need to do, NWAPA, and the scale of what you need for disaster protection now and as we go along, and change, and in the course of it, changing the biosphere, is so exemplified by that FDR Glass-Steagall era approach to dealing with the 1937 and 38 crises. Paul can report on this. Let me just throw in one thing. There is a new, I refer everyone, there's a new 20 or 30 minute LPAC TV thing on the new CCC in NWAPA. But this is on new how the Public Works Projects Administration and CCC helped in the emergency.
Yeah, I mean, this is in talking to people now in organizing in the aftermath of the weather disasters that we've been discussing, many people understand this immediately, that the United States needs a North American Water and Power Alliance, a continental water management, power development, infrastructure platform for improvement of the weather, for control of management and purification of water, and the productive use of water, and protection from flooding of this kind all over the continent. And, you know, this brings mankind to a different level, but it also relaunches the United States in a productive and creative direction. People can see that. An example of this, we had in our report this morning, although in a smaller context, obviously, but nonetheless, when FDR confronted these similar weather disasters in 37 and 38, the Four Corners projects of water management and electrical power and infrastructure had already been built in the first few years of the Roosevelt administration. And so he says himself, and compare this, this is Roosevelt himself writing, "When it became evident that the perilous conditions in the Ohio Valley would be even more challenging than the previous year, I set up a flood committee consisting of the following members: Harry L. Hopkins, Works Project Administrator; Admiral William D. Leahy, Chief of Naval Operations; General Mollen Craig, Chief of Staff; Rear Admiral Russell Wakesh, Commander of the Coast Guard; Rear Admiral Cary Grayson, Chairman of the American Red Cross; and Robert Fechner, Director of the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCC. This grew out of a White House conference at which we perceived the necessity for coordination of all government efforts. One of the vacant offices in the White House was assigned to Chairman Hopkins, and during the emergency, the committee met with me twice daily to map out plans for a concerted attack on the problem." Now, he then describes the incredible numbers of mobilization of instantly of more than 100,000 WPA employees. This was then done again the next year when there was a huge freak hurricane that hit New England, sort of like a Katrina that hit New England instead. And 140,000 to 150,000 employees were rushed to New England in order to contain the threatened complete devastation of Connecticut and Rhode Island by the Connecticut River. And they just stayed there and built and built and built not only sandbags
flood
and levees
and
flood walls and so on, but housing, rebuilt
toilet
roads
and
sanitary treatment facilities and so forth. But the attitude of the president in taking this, as Dennis was saying, in what had to be done with Haiti, and clearly was not done, although it was presented to Obama in clear evacuation and rebuilding plans by LaRouche, by other people, by task forces from outside the Obama administration. He wouldn't do it. He wouldn't have anything to do with it, with the disaster that resulted. Compare, and the same thing with this flooding emergency, compare the approach and the attitude that Franklin Roosevelt had. And it was within the context but of something larger, but as Dennis is indicating, we are talking about a context in the North American Water and Power Alliance projects, which is far, far larger than that. It's 30 times, 35 times, just in terms of the work, the employment and the infrastructure building, as large as the TVA. So this is real employment in facing this kind of emergency and the causes of these weather emergencies.
Right. Well, let's get on to the some of the manifestations of unemploying the whole world. Although it's obviously, it maybe goes without saying, we're dealing with the United States because we have to have a shift and stop this. And it has to start here in the United States in Washington. But among the in the cohorts that of the population that are unemployed, a huge number are people between 18 and not older than 24 or 25. Is that right, Paul?
Mm-hmm.
And you, people should look. I mentioned at the August 26 EIR online. Paul has an article, "Labor to Rebuild the World," is currently being thrown on the global scrap heap. Would you say something about this, about the U.S., the transatlantic, and the world? Because if you take employment as a percent of population, that's what you stressed.
In there, yeah. Because, it's popularly talked about that the supposed number of officially unemployed people in the world since the collapse began in 07, since the financial blowout occurred, that has risen from 140 million to 205 million. It's a complete and total underestimate. But of that, 55% of the increase has been in the United States and the European countries. So in the most skilled workforces is where the greatest increase in unemployment has occurred, in the countries with perhaps the greatest capacities for contributing and investing, constructing such new infrastructure as maglev rail, nuclear power plants, the equipment necessary for the NWAPA project, and so forth. In the heartlands of such capabilities is where the greatest increase, in fact, most of the increase in unemployment has taken place. Now, if you look at the United States and you try to get an idea of how many people really need work, it's immense. It's not at all what's reported. I did a study of the workforce for the 90s and the last decade. I just noticed that it was updated by a new study, not by me, but it published in Forbes magazine just now, which takes it through this month, that in the last 12 years, from the beginning of 2000 to roughly now, near the end of 2011, in those 12 years, the civilian, non-institutionalized population over 16 and below 65 in the United States, that is the potential creative workforce, it has increased by 28 million in that period of time, mainly by people coming of age, teenagers and people in the 20s, the youngest part of the workforce, but also by people migrating into the country and in any other way that they may join the workforce. 28 million people. The number of net jobs created during that same 12 years is 3 million. And of those 3 million, 2.7 million were farm jobs.
I saw that. Food jobs, farm.
Uh-huh. So in the non-farm economy, it's zero. With 28 million people having additionally potentially entered the workforce. So what does that mean? They haven't entered it at all. They are just scraping, trying to survive, trying to do something else. Their talents, their abilities, and their education is being wasted, and they can't find work. So we're talking in terms of real unemployment. Add that to the official figures. You're talking of people who need work, who have no work at all, in excess of 30 million. And then on top of that, all the people who are forced to work part-time because their hours have been cut and so forth. That's, including at very high skill levels, that is the magnitude of the workforce looking for employment, right, and perishing without it. So, again, this can only be met by really reaching for the greatest possible advance in productivity and investment, which is embodied in the NWAPA outline.
Yeah, I'd actually like to jump in here because two things. One is I want to plug that actually at LaRouchePAC.com, we're going to be, over the coming week, we're going to put together a segment, a package on this exactly what you're bringing up there, Paul, with the youth unemployment, more particularly that you have a lot of these people who are preparing for participating productively into the society, and that's just simply not there. And I'd actually like to put out a call to any of our listeners who have any stories or anything that they could contribute to that. To send it in to info@larouchepac.com email address, info@larouchepac.com, to help us put together the material for this report that we want to put together this upcoming week. But I wanted to jump in, too, because there's another aspect which goes along with this question of the younger generation, which is the sense of the future, of contributing, of being a necessary part of the society in which you find yourself. Because when you look at the youngest part of the younger generation, you know, you look at between the ages of, say, 16 and 25 or so, and this is a generation who has grown up in a world, and not just in the United States, but internationally. This is a generation where, when you've seen a lot of these recent riots, these flash mobs and whatnot, that's the generation which is really carrying these things out. And when you look at the identity, the cultural identity of this generation, one thing to keep in mind is that this is a generation who has grown up in a world which has never, they have never known a world where there was a president of the United States of America who was decent, right? Mm-hmm. You have had these people come to maturity under the George Bush Jr. administrations and under the Barack Obama administration. And so some of these intangibles of living in a society which is contributing to the future of that society is one of the things that I think is going to be degenerating cultural trend can be reversed with the type of national mission objective which NWAPA represents. Because, you know, when you're looking at a project of this magnitude, you're not looking at some short-term fix-it kind of thing. You're looking at an investment cycles of decades and generations in scope, and so you can't help but when becoming involved with something like this, to imagine a future state of the society, and then recognize that the work that you're contributing that particular day, whether it be digging a ditch to prepare the ground for the road equipment to come through, to pave the road, to lay down the rail, to get the cement out up to Alaska to begin building one of these dams, You know, that when you have a sense of participation in something like that, because, you know, this aspect of the youth unemployment, you know, it's especially, I was thinking about this, looking at some of these figures for the 16, particularly the 16 to 19-year-old age bracket, which, you know, is well, it's well over 20% across the country. It's as high as 50% in some places where over the summer the kids couldn't find a job. And it's not just a, you know, a proxy daycare for the youth. When you have that summer job when you're young, whether or not you recognize it, you get a sense, A, that you're contributing to the society, you know, because, you know, a lot of these flash mob youth, when asked why they did it, later on they would say, well, I just wanted to be a part of something. Mm-hmm. You know, that these kids are looking, thirsting to be a part of something, and this degenerate flash mob kind of thing is right now what's available to them. Now, if you
this summer, by the way, was the lowest on record for employment of 16 to 19 year olds
mm-hmm.
ever.
Mm-hmm.
Less than a quarter of 16 to 19 year olds had jobs. Sorry, Dennis, I just wanted to.
No, yeah, no, that's important because that also shows, at least to the youth, whether or not they're conscious of the fact, it has the indelible effect on their idea of society, that currently it shows that the society doesn't really care about them at all, that they have no place in the society. Mm-hmm. That, you know, so what does it matter if I go out and I destroy the mom and pop shops that are just down the street from my house in my own neighborhood, because it doesn't really matter because the society doesn't really do anything for me anyways, right?
It doesn't do anything for anyone at all, because everyone around me is likewise.
Right.
Right.
So this aspect of identity is really, I think, an important aspect, which is addressed by because, you know, another thing is we've had a lot recently of growing support for the Glass-Steagall, the re-implementation of the Glass-Steagall legislation, separating out the banks, basically shutting down, pulling a beautiful flank against the British Empire, crushing them, is what Glass-Steagall really is. And there's been a growing urgency, sense of urgency in some of these institutions. But, you know, there has to be also a sense of urgency on this question of a national mission objective, particularly NOAPA, the same sense of urgency, especially from some of these institutions which have backed up the House H.R. 1489. The unions really, you know, the conditions by which the unions were able to solidify as a force, an advocate for the people, really took place under Roosevelt with the consolidation of these Four Corners projects. You know, that the roots of you know, particularly these unions, their identity really is in these kinds of giant programs and projects. But, you know, if we don't launch in tandem with getting Obama, you know, nullified from a position of authority, putting in Glass-Steagall, and if we don't immediately move on NOAPA, we're at a point now, what, you know, you were bringing up a little bit earlier, where the skilled people in our society are getting old, and we have essentially a short window of opportunity to be able to pass some of these because, you know, there's certain things you can get out of studying and whatnot, but you in order to build something on the scale of NOAPA, and in order to revive the scientific and engineering capability of the United States, we are going to rely on some of these old hands who may have been out of their field for the past, you know, maybe decade or decades and longer, because the whole field has been wiped out. These folks need to be brought back in to work with some of these younger folks, some of the more sharp of this younger generation, to rebuild the living sense of knowledge, which is going to be required to to initially in the United States to embark on this project. We have to do that, A, before we lose this older generation, but B, also before we lose the younger generation beyond any hope of recovery, I would say.
Yeah, I think it goes up into, I mean, when you think of this, you put it in a generational term, which is good. When you think of this as having gone on now for 12, 13 years, I mean, by comparison, the decade before 2000, of these people coming of age or entering the workforce eligibility in some other way, getting out of prison, whatever, however it was, but the majority of them did so by coming of age. And 80% of them during the 90s entered the workforce. During the course of that decade, they became members of the workforce. In the last decade, only 30% of them have entered the workforce at all. That means not that they have jobs, but they may just be looking for work. And the other 70% are not even looking, have never gotten their first job, and may now be in their late 20s and have never been able to enter the workforce. So they've been hanging out at a community college or they've been taking care of relatives or something. But this is, as Dennis was indicating, across, we're talking about 20 to 20 plus million people between the ages of 16 and the late 20s. 20 to 25 million people, of whom the great majority have not been allowed to enter productive and creative employment or any kind of employment. This is completely abnormal, as shown by the decade before. Not that that was, anything perfect, but it's a completely abnormal situation which leads to devastating consequences, cultural consequences, and consequences in terms of their potential optimism about themselves and about society. So this includes in that generational that has been shunted onto the scrap heap in that sense, it includes veterans. It includes people who've already been into the Iraq and Afghanistan and so forth, theaters of war several times, or have been serving otherwise in the military and then come out, and they have some skills and they have some personal strength in most cases. Same thing. Their official unemployment of the Iraq-era war veterans is 17%. That's a nonsense figure. It's really close to 30% in terms of those who potentially could be in the workforce. So, I mean, that's just to give more of a sense of the magnitude, and it's happening in all of the European countries as well. In every single one, the percentage of the population that is employed is still going down. You know, during this last 2 years when they were claiming recovery is going on and so forth, the percentage of the population employed in all of those countries, United States and Europe, kept going down. And it's still, now its fall is accelerating again.
And you, in this EIR article of yours, Paul, I think you also have figures for Spain, for France, and elsewhere. I think of the young, the unemployment among the young is official figures are very high.
It's astronomical, 41% official youth unemployment in Spain. It's hard to, even that means in real terms, 70% of them who are looking have no jobs. And it's directly connected to the countries which have been subjected to the bailout conditions. Greece, Spain has been subjected to them without getting a bailout yet. Ireland, Portugal, those countries are being driven into hopeless economic contraction. Greece is contracting at almost 8% a year now, and that's why the Greek bailout is failing. They can't possibly take on additional debt when their economy is contracting in that way because of the cuts that they've made.
Right. Well, Paul, let me ask you one thing, and Dennis, again, interject if you will, but I know, Paul, over the years, you've often looked at demographics, I mean, different the condition of different age groups, the populations of different countries. And did you not look at the Dark Age? I mean, Mr. LaRouche, Dennis, the LaRouche Political Action Committee website is saying that's what we're facing. That's what's underway, the Dark Age process. Mm-hmm. But literally, and you see that in New Orleans, which was depopulated by 117,000 or some people since 2005. Detroit is depopulated. The entire Great Lakes is depopulated. And they're just disappeared. You know, mm-hmm. it's like the people disappeared in South America and under certain political conditions, but these are disappeared. Say something about the Dark Age, literally at the time, where people were disappeared. They got plague or death.
Well,
in the 1300s.
LaRouche has said many times over a long period of time that we face a repeat, the only thing comparable, and he thinks we're in worse, facing a worse collapse of civilization now than then. But the only thing comparable is what happened in the 14th century, which is was caused by a global banking collapse. It was a complicated structure, not similar to the huge mega banks that we see today. But nonetheless, there was a global banking collapse in the middle of the 14th century. And it wasn't just in Italy, as it's often reported historically. It was worldwide, and it actually began, ironically, in China and then in India, where these Venetian banks had their biggest operations.
I think West of England quit paying also.
Well, that's
the sheep farmers said, we're going to quit paying.
That's who quit paying, but the people started dying. The population started dropping, and people started dying off in large numbers in China first. And in India, which were the most populous parts of the world at that time, as they are now. and then the impacts of this completely uncorrected, I mean, there were not nations capable of doing it at that time, this completely uncorrected explosion and blowout of all of the bank and credit in the world, essentially, resulted in half of the Catholic parishes of Europe becoming empty, disappearing as populated parishes in the way that you now see areas of Detroit, also areas of Hartford, Connecticut, areas of many cities around the country becoming progressively depopulated, and the cities taking the strategy of knocking down the foreclosed homes and leaving open area so that they don't have to maintain those homes and so forth. This same depopulation, but what LaRouche is talking about is the Haiti phenomenon then being imposed, the phenomenon we see in Africa being imposed by this collapse on the entire world. Against that, we need the kind of really powerful thrust of human creativity and ingenuity. And a real, as Dennis was saying, a generational leap in productivity through a generation-long new infrastructure platform represented by the NOAPA project. That's how you bring it back. And people can see, as I said, people can see right now that this is the way you respond to what we've just been hit with what the country has just been hit with these national disasters. You respond with a emergency mobilization, but with a mission. And to do that, you know, we have a total obstacle in the White House that we have to get out of there.
Right. Well, Dennis, you raised the question of guts. I mean, that's the picture that's being painted here. You could say it speaks for itself, but people don't hear it. That's the point. Their sense. Don't see it, don't hear it, meaning those who are being gutless. And you can't exactly order a package of guts online, although that would be something to think about. But you're putting together the kind of thing you describe and ask people, you can ask people again about the real condition of the situation, unemployment, because it's part of telling the truth in order to rally the guts, right? Rally the people who will act.
Yeah, and I'll put it out there again that, yeah, we're going to be putting together this for people who have just tuned in over the course of the hour. At LPAC TV, we're going to be producing a segment, a package on this unemployment and underemployment of the youth. And if anybody out there, if anybody out there has some material, a story that they would like to share, that we can get in contact with you, to send an email out to info@larouchepac.com. Again, that's info@larouchepac.com. Because, you know, the reason, it is a question of guts. You know, the reason that we're, one of the reasons that we're putting this together on the website is in tandem to give more depth to the series that we're wrapping up this evening on the new presidency with our six candidates across the nation. And, you know, what one of the more important things is this idea of a unified national approach to changing the situation and the willingness to get up and fight for it is what's represented by these six campaigns. It's not, because, you know, it's not, let's see, what's the best way to put it? You know, it, whatever you use to try and describe the situation, whether you look at it financially or you look at the physical collapse, or you look at our inability to respond to disasters, or you look at the fact that we don't have enough food that we've grown this past year to sustain humanity next year. You look at any of these things, the contraction of our cities and towns, by any metric, you can see that something needs to be done. And then if you look clearly on the LaRouche PAC website, our organizing, what's represented, what the six candidates, the slate of LaRouche candidates have been doing around the nation, the solution is very clear and known. It's no mystery what needs to be done. You can look at it from what we're putting out today, presently on our website and also in EIR, or if you look at historical precedents. We've been mentioning Roosevelt many times over the course of this hour. It's not unknown what to do about the situation. The only question is whether or not we're going to take the step and actually do it. And I think that it's another important thing to bring up. I was bringing up earlier about some of these mobs and whatnot amongst the youth. If you then look at the slightly older but still relatively young generation below the boomers, if you look in the bracket from 25 to 45, and if you look around the world at some of these movements which have been springing up, which have the initial reaction to do something constructive. For example, you have the Indignados movement in Spain, what has spread from that movement throughout different parts of Europe, into Greece, into France, and in different places. Or if you look here in the United States with this takeover Wall Street group that you have forming in New York, and these people are putting forward, or their reaction is to do something constructive about the crisis. Now, then when you look at people who are in the nominal leadership right now of the nation, you look at the Congress, who has, you know, like, you look at the super committee. I mean, one thing that you should actually have happen, you know, is just have the Congress, who isn't on the super committee, legislate action to turn that super committee into a body to impeach Barack Obama. That'd be kind of nice. You know?
Give him a mission. Give him a mission.
Yeah, because but you've had this generation shirking the responsibility of dealing with this very real crisis that's coming down on us, and it is a question of guts. And I could say, and Mr. LaRouche brings this up often, the effect that the assassination of the Kennedys had, and the cover-up of those assassinations had on this baby boomer generation in the main. Now, what we need to do is, because there are some There are some better people amongst that generation who can be inspired to action, but only if they're inspired to act. And that is that's the role, one of the roles right now of the slate of six congressional candidates, and also is the role of anybody who's listening to this, the regular listeners to this show, the people who read the EIR on a regular basis, people who go to LaRouche PAC on a regular basis, is to take what we're doing here and spread it, organize around it, use this as ammunition, which is why we're asking for people to send in some of their stories for ammunition for this package that we're going to put together. Because what we're doing over at LPAC is providing you the ammunition by which to fight. Because, you know, it's not going to be some logical argument of wouldn't this be nice that's going to give people the guts to, you're not going to guilt somebody to have the guts to fight a battle. They'll wilt in the face of the enemy. But as people get more and more of a sense of what it actually means to be human, like what NWAPA is, yeah, it's a project, but that project is an expression of an idea of man. And it's that idea of man, which is like the fundamental basis for why we created a nation in the first place. It's that which needs to be reawakened in all segments of our society right now in order to get us through this crisis. And by that, when people have a more awakened sense of what it really means to be part of this republic, the United States of America, then getting rid of Obama is a no-brainer. That takes no effort. That takes nothing. But our job right now is to organize that sense of national, not just national, but there's a sense of identity in people such that we have the guts to do what's necessary right now.
Right, thank you. And let me ask Paul in the remaining minute or so. We have a few minutes, and Dennis, you can conclude if you like. But Paul, you perform hazardous duty. A lot of people may know it. He spends a couple of days on Capitol Hill trying to deal with the situation where even some people know what's going on. I'd like you to just describe that for everyone, because people have to. It's not lobbying as usual now. This is the end of the line. Order Congress what to do. But there may be, take Glass-Steagall, as Dennis was saying, you have a lot of people supporting it. I think now the number of congressmen is officially 35, not including Marcy Kaptur. But what do you want to say in light of what Dennis is advising everyone to do now?
Well, there are really two Glass-Steagall restoration bills in the House. Between them, they have over 40 sponsors now.
Okay.
You know, that has been the result of the clarity of the collapse, particularly the way the financial collapse has reappeared in full force in Europe in the European banking system in the last 6 months. And it's become clear that the Federal Reserve and otherwise, this is all one global bailout policy with disastrous results. So a few members, really only one or two members who had real guts, decided to push this in a way that we could push it. And the result has been that whereas when it's been introduced in the past, it's had one or two sponsors. Now it has more than 40. But it's clear that And LaRouche was saying this again this week in his presidential message, and then again in the talk that he made last night. It's clear that Obama is the obstacle to that. That both for the Democratic Party, he is the great obstacle, and also being totally opposed on behalf of Wall Street and London, being totally opposed to this. That in itself is a reason that he has to go. When this is introduced into the Senate, I think it will rapidly expand in the House. But as he said, and many of these people, although they lack as Dennis was saying, they lack the guts to act decisively. They understand the situation is getting incomparably worse and that the credit of the United States has been ruined. And in order to invest in this kind of breakout in the economy and in the workforce, you have to restore, get hold of the credit and issue credit in a new system for that purpose. So you have to stop Wall Street from ruining it, and that's been propelling the idea of Glass-Steagall restoration has become nationally a real driving force. The problem is taking on Obama, as you see with the trade unions and their response to this move that he's making now. That's what they've got to do.
Yeah, maybe you want to say one more. In other words, you have, as Dennis was describing, expressions of support. North Carolina AFL-CIO just had their statewide meeting. They expressed their, that's the seventh state to specifically express the desire, the demand to have the reinstatement of Glass-Steagall as the national supports. You have that the National Farmers Union is having a fly-in for a few days in the this coming week around September 12, 13, 14. And they're, as an organization, they support that. But it's got to go the whole way.
Yeah, I look at the example of the head of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trump. Immediately before Obama spoke, he put out a statement saying about this Georgia Works forcing the unemployed to work for their unemployment benefits that I was discussing before. He put out a statement saying, on behalf of the AFL-CIO, saying this is slave labor. We oppose it. We don't think it's legal. We would oppose its expansion. Obama makes a speech, promotes the expansion of the exact Georgia Works, and the next day Trump says, I support it. I support the president's new... So they have to take on the disastrous president. Therefore Glass-Steagall, but it isn't going to work unless we have executive leadership with this kind of a mission. And he, this nullity, it can't happen with Obama there.
Well, that's a mission. Do you want to add anything to our mission statement, Dennis?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's real. That's this question of guts and just, you know, lighting fires under the butts of people, putting boots in the butts of people.
Okay.
That's what we need to do right now,
That's it, boots in the butts.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to thank you. I'm going to say
boots.
One thing.
Work boots in the butts.
Yeah, work boots in the butts. This is, I'm going to add one thing. I think in the next 24 hours or much sooner, there will be a special LPAC TV feature. Is that right, Dennis, on the September 11th and the real story of the British and Saudi?
Yes. That is going to be on the site this evening.
Okay.
I urge everybody to look at that.
And we will have, I think, Jeff Steinberg, potentially Leandra Bernstein. She's part of the team that's involved in this. We'll have the following week, but be sure and watch that on LaRouchePack.com on the real story of the September 11th. And otherwise, I want to thank Dennis Mason, Paul Gallagher. This is September 10th, 2011, LaRouche Show. Marcia Baker signing off. Thank you very much.